Hi, I'm Nick Gregoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show, and this episode is one that's very close to my heart because it's with a dear friend of mine and one of my favorite people in the whole world, Darren Bartlett, amazing Jiu-Jitsu black belt and an independent filmmaker who has made what I believe to be the best documentary about Jiu-Jitsu available. It's called Tradition, and it follows the career of Roger Gracie. It's an absolute work of art. Fantastic film. Anyone who's got even a passing interest in Jiu-Jitsu owes it to himself to check this out. You can actually get it from my online store, which is found at store.jiu-jitsubrotherhood.com, and you'll find it for sale on there under books and videos. I'll leave a link in the episode description on the site as well. Okay guys, here we go. Darren Bartlett, enjoy. Hey guys, welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood podcast, and I have someone that I've been trying to get on the show for, well, pretty much since the show began a year and a half ago. It's my very good friend, Darren Bartlett, who is, I'd have to say, nothing less than a legend in his own time. How are you doing, Darren?
Good, my friend. Good. Yeah, very auspicious opening that.
As I said to you when I finally connected with you on this call a few minutes ago, you are literally like the Jiu-Jitsu international man of mystery and slippery as an eel to pin down, because you're always flying all over the world making these awesome films and doing cool stuff. What have you been up to lately?
Do you know what, Nick? I've been up mountains. I've been making a film about shepherds now for about 8 years.
Okay.
The hardest guys I've ever met, real tough guys, work 7 days a week, 365 a year, uh-huh. No messing about. And then they scale 3,000 foot peaks every day to herd their, you know, to animal husbandry to a different level. It's incredible.
And then they have like dogs with them and stuff. Is that the kind of?
Yeah. I mean, they bring in, it's an amazing sight to see, you know, 2,000 sheep coming down a valley being guided in by 4 shepherds and 12 dogs.
Wow.
You know, it's some serious, you know, Nick, I enjoy to see things. I like spectacles. I like culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a very, very nice, and I feel very privileged to be allowed into that world. And I remember the first time I went out with these guys, it was a real hot day, and I see them coming down this track, and they're on quads and dogs everywhere, and I said to the guy, look, can I come out with you? He said, well, we're going out now. So I said, great, I'll grab my cameras, is that okay, I'll take some photos. They said, if you can keep up. I remember laughing. I was fit. It was about 8 years ago. I was fit, and I was like, yeah, no problem, my man. So I grabbed a bottle of water, put a rucksack, chased after them. Well, I ran out of water within the first hour, and they were on the fell for 9 hours. So, they're real tough guys. So,
jeez. I've
been making that film, and then the other film I've been working on for now 7 years is the quite controversial sport, a cultural manifestation, if you like, of sulky racing with the gypsies.
I want to hear all about this. So, for the Americans listening, you might not be familiar with the gypsies in Europe and England.
I don't think that's a correct term. We have to use the word traveller or something.
Traveller, okay, traveller.
So, travellers now. He's a foreign world now.
Fair enough. So these travellers are literally, it's my understanding, you can correct me please if I'm wrong, but for those of you who've seen the film Snatch and the Brad Pitt character and his family, it is literally those kinds of people. Is that correct?
Yes.
Wow. And something that blew my mind is I overheard a mutual friend of ours, he was talking to me about you and this film that you're making, and he related an anecdote or something that you said to him, which was that you feel surprisingly at home with them, which I always thought was pretty funny, knowing you.
I think, I'll be honest with you, you know, this is quite, it's not a very... The system of the travellers live by is quite straightforward. You know, they venerate very little, but your ability to hold your hands up, you know, turn a pound note, train a horse, you know, these kind of things are venerated in their society. So, mm-hmm. And if you do have a problem, as a rule, you know, you can settle your differences on the cobbles, as they say, you know.
So. Okay.
And you're not likely to get kicked to death by a mob or stabbed or nothing of this nature. You know, if you have a beef with someone or someone has a beef with you, you know, you can generally resolve it. If not, if you want to take it a stage further, then they have this thing called fair play, where, you know, you give the man fair play, you square up to each other, you have a bit of a do, and then, you know, you shake hands and it's dealt with. And yeah. I think this is a very sensible way to deal with problems, you know?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, think of how far removed that is from where I live, United States. It's as far from that as possible. Not only is there no fair play, it turns into this massive legal battle that spans months or years and costs a huge amount of money and goes into all these tricks of language, and just it's completely the antithesis of that. So I really do respect and appreciate that way of doing things.
Yeah, it's a very litigious world, my friend. And, you know, I heard Enzo chatted about this one time, you know, and he said the same thing, is that, you know, people are so ready in you know, the supposed first world to be rude and ignorant, slam the door in your face, you know, belittle a woman in front of you. And you know, it's very difficult to, you know, to redress that in the moment. Because the guy's going, if you smack the guy in the mouth for being ignorant, you know, the guy's going to sue you. So, and like you describe it, it becomes an unnecessary burden on a world that's already quite complicated. So, yeah, so that's why we don't do these things.
Exactly.
It's a very comfortable environment. I'll be honest with you. When I hang out with these guys, it's a very comfortable environment, and I actually see some, you know, I've seen some not so choice things. But I've seen some real skill, both in, you know, in surviving and also in the world and working with horses, you know, some amazing things. I mean, you can't mess about with horses. They always say, look, a horse is dangerous front, back, and the middle. There's no messing about with a horse, and especially the horses they work with are stallions, as a rule, stallions and mares, you know, and they're quite, they're basically coloured racehorses, you know. They've got, they say that these horses, trotting horses, they're like thoroughbreds with an extra gear, because they run 2 miles, 2 miles straight road, bang, flat out with a horse on the back, with a rider on the back, with a car on the back. But yeah, so it's an incredible thing to see. I think the only other people that used to have coloured horses were the Native Americans. That's so that typically that kind of horse, skewbald or piebald, black and white or brown and white.
Okay.
Amazing. I've seen some. I've been kicked a few times by horses, and yeah, you know.
It's not fun.
That's not fun at all, man.
I'm going to be straight up. Horses terrify me, dude. I never go near them. They just absolutely terrify me. And it all started for me with Christopher Reeve's accident. I think it was 20 years ago when he fell off and became a quadriplegic. I was just like, this is too much of an unknown entity. You know what I mean? Like, at least with a motorbike, you have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen. Whereas a horse is this massive animal. No matter how trained it is, you don't know, dude. You're never fully in control of that thing, no matter how much you might think you are. And it kind of, it's always just scared the shit out of me.
But they've got two reactions, horses, fight or flight. Uh-huh. And if they can't get away, then they get real busy trying to impose their will and what they want. You know, like the guy I'm making the film about, one of the guys, there's three brothers, one of them. I mean, he's got no front teeth. He had them kicked out.
Jesus Christ.
He was helping someone with their horse, helping onto a transport wagon, and it kicked out and bang, caught him.
God,
I mean,
damn.
So he took his teeth straight out.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, there was this at an intersection near where we lived. There was this guy who was, bless his soul, he was developmentally delayed and really not having a good time of life. And he was always standing begging at the street corner. And I found out later that he'd been kicked in the head by a horse. And that was another thing that, you know, stuck in my mind. Like, do not go anywhere near the back of a horse ever. it's pretty scary. So it's my understanding you loved spending time with these travelers and in that that racing world so much that you went out and bought a horse for yourself.
Yes. Yeah, it was a classic tale. I mean, they say never buy a horse from a traveler, and so someone told me about his horse. It was a young horse, 10 months old, and And the guy wanted to get rid of it. So I went, looked at the horse, and I felt a little sorry for it, as you do, standing in a muddy field. I thought, but I like to get involved,
Mm-hmm.
I like to get involved and so I can experience what people are going through. For example, I mean, in 2004, when I first started filming Roger, I just decided, right, I should enter the worlds because I'm in Brazil. I should do it. I should fight at Blue Belt, and
mm-hmm.
yeah, that was a sharp learning curve, never competed before. And in Brazil, because it was a different animal then, people didn't go with experience. That was really one of the only places to go and get involved.
Yeah.
But thought about myself, but it gave me an insight to maybe what Roger may be going through, probably times 10, because mm-hmm. the pressure mounted on him and his name and everything. But yeah, you learn a little bit about yourself. So yeah, I went to see this horse, and I had no intention of paying the money the guy was asking. Half an hour later, I had the horse leading it away, and I'd paid the guy, and I was thanking him for the opportunity. So,
classic.
So yeah, we got involved and with the horse and took it out on the road, and yeah, we still work with the horse. Still have the horse.
What's the horse's name?
Prince Buster.
Oh, nice. And you've grown pretty attached to him now, or what?
It's a nice horse. It's a lovely horse. It's a beautiful animal. It's a stallion, big black and white, 17 uh-huh. hands. It's not to be toyed with. It's an animal uh-huh. that, like I say, he likes to get his head down and run. That's
yeah. I absolutely, Darren, I love that about you, that expression, I like to get involved. And, I think when you live your life like that, there was a film with Jim Carrey maybe 10 years ago, I think it was called The Yes Man or something like that. And he makes this decision to say yes to every opportunity that presents itself in his life. He doesn't consider the consequences. He just says yes. And it leads him on this whole series of adventures. And it basically enlivens him because he was very depressed and bored with his life up until that point. And I think there's something to be said for that. Just going where the day takes you, just diving in and just, instead of being a spectator in life, being an actual participant. And I really respect that so much about you, Darren. It's a great testament to your character, my brother.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Nick. To be honest with you, as a filmmaker, especially a very independent filmmaker, if I went with these ideas to get back in or to some, established media outlet So I've got this idea. I want to make a film about travellers and this racing, and it's not right for them.
Uh-huh.
Who are we going to sell it to? Too many questions get thrown up, uh-huh. and I just look at the opportunity and not how. So I just dive in there, and it takes a little while, obviously, because you start pointing cameras at certain groups of people. They might question that, but
mm-hmm.
I ingratiated myself slowly in both the shepherds and the travellers and the community. And I've been all up and down the land for both. That's spend cool. a lot of time in Cumbria, and I spend a lot of, I go as far as Glasgow with the racing.
Wow.
I've seen a few things.
That's pretty cool. Just last question back to the shepherds, Darren. I'm interested to know, particularly because of the way they live out in nature and they spend so much time outdoors. One of the things I've realize about myself, it took me a long, long, long time to get to this point, but I've realized that the quickest way for me to be unhappy is for me to spend a long time indoors, and the quickest way for me to become happy again is to spend some time outdoors. And I was just wondering if you noticed, because of their particular lifestyle, do they seem generally like happier, healthier people than the average over-civilized Westerner you meet in London or New York?
Absolutely, Nick. I mean, to say these people, the shepherds are remote is a bit of an understatement. They really are quite remote. And, I talk to them about things and they just look at me like bemused, like, what are you even talking about? some current affairs or what's that then?
Yeah.
I like this. It's people recalibrating themselves or never being calibrated to the modern world quite in the same way or not interacting with the modern world in the same way. Uh-huh. And absolutely, rain or shine, when you're under the elements, it's funny, when I started, in every film you should have a hero. You should cast the characters in each film. And it's often it's quite obvious who is the heroine, who's the hero, this leads you on the narrative. You know, it makes it easy to identify the narrative in a film. Mm-hmm. I toyed with the idea of this film, Dog and Stick, it's called. For a long time, maybe 2-3 years, I couldn't work out who the hero was. Was it the shepherd, or was it the dogs, or was it
the sheep? One,
I had an epiphany, and it was obvious. It was the fell. Fell where the shepherds, you know, the peaks and the amazing dramatic place, raw countryside that this is farmed. Unique as far as Britain goes, the most dramatic countryside in Britain, without a doubt. And particularly the Burradale Valley, which happens to be the wettest place in the country by 100 inches of rain.
Wow.
And so they see a lot of adverse weather. And it's the life and death game. I asked them once, what is shepherd? And he says, it's a game of life and death. You're tasked with the responsibility of looking after these animals. And if you don't, they die. After a while.
That's sorry to interrupt you, Darren, but the thing that I find fascinating about that is, the average person who walks into Marks and Spencer's, which is a store in England, and picks up a wool sweater or gets a lamb chop or whatever, I don't know how often they connect what actually has gone into getting that thing to them for $5 or $20 or $50 or whatever it is. Forget all the logistics of transporting and stuff, but just as you said, this game of life and death, these guys are out in the rain, in the cold, guarding these 2,000 sheep, and they know if they make one mistake, everything's lost.
Yeah, it's absolutely that way. I've learned so much about, for example, the heft of a flock. Because a lot of these are National Trust farms that these guys run, the National Trust owns the farm, and they would own the flock with which that lives on the farm. And the reason being is that there's a thing called a heft. A heft is the collective knowledge of the group of sheep. So the sheep can theoretically run for 60 miles across the fells, but they don't, because the collective knowledge is passed down from you down to the lambs. And as far as sheep farming goes, you know, these sheep live a particularly long life, because 7 years the ewes don't go to market, because they need to pass on this heft in flock, and it's a particularly gamey meat, and that comes off the fact it's on the fell. So it's, you know, somewhere between sort of wild farming, I guess. And I like it. I like it. I see these animals living like animals, proud. You know, I always look for the romantic, as in sort of a Japanese approach to anything, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, I look for the proud and the beauty, even amongst the not-so-nice things and not-so-nice animals.
You know? Yeah,
let me just tell you a little story. Once I was on the films. And I was on the fell with the because it's a very dangerous place. I mean, the place I'm filming is called the Burradale Valley, and it takes a lot of lives down there. Not a lot, but every now and then. For this country, a lot. You know, you can easily get caught out, fall, get caught in weather, hypothermia in certain times of the year. I was on the fell once with them, and I was really high, and I was coming down, and I'd lost the walkie-talkie of one of the shepherds that – is particularly pedantic about everything he owns. And so I was coming down, I thought, damn, I've lost his thing. And they was kind of waiting for me at the bottom. And I must have been 1,000 foot above them, but on the fell. And I started to look for it. And in my sort of panic, I slipped and I fell. And as I fell, I realized I was coming down head first into some, you know, I didn't know what was underneath this bracken. So I tucked, went over, sort of landed on my shoulders, and then fell. And I must have fell, you know, 50 foot down this thing.
But God damn.
And when I got to the bottom, one of the shepherds said to me that one of the other shepherds next to him had looked. They'd all seen what was going on. One was looking through the binoculars. He went, I'd give that a 10.
Classic.
You know, they're very – and I thought, wow, you know, they must be thinking I'm a fool. And then I got drunk with them a few times. And then I started to realize that these guys – are not as superhuman. They're as mortal as we are on that fell, because they started to recant tales of when they nearly slipped or fell, they got caught out. And I started to realize that they are just fallible. They just have a wider knowledge. You know, knowledge is everything, and that's what separates them and keeps them alive, you know, on that film.
That's awesome. I was thinking of when you said you see these animals as proud and use another adjective, but I totally get that. And again, it's so far removed from the concept of like a factory farm, you know, where this animal that, you know, has every right to life that human beings do, even if we're going to use them for food and put them back into the protein chain, still we disrespect them to such a level. And I'm reminded, you mentioned you like to look at things in that Japanese way. You know, there's a particular region of Japan, I think it's called Wagyu, where they produce this high quality beef. And every year the farmers have a festival and an honoring of the cattle and the cows, because, you know, they know they're taking the lives of these animals, but then they want to venerate them and respect them. And I'm guessing these shepherds do a similar kind of thing. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Your flock's the reflection of you. If your flock is poor, you're not a good farmer. So there is the pride, there's the badge of honor. If you've got a healthy flock, and that's why the show inside, they show their sheep, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. During the summer months when things are a little bit slower on the farm, they indulge in all these rural sports. That's the first thing that drew me to there, because I took Maurizio Gomez, my mm-hmm. master jiu-jitsu, I took him to teach at Eton. And one of the masters there, who's now a good friend of mine, he told me about this Cumberland and Westmoreland wrestling, which goes back to the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. and the Victorian fairs that they have during the summer months that have all these antiquated sports. When they do the wrestling, for example, they sort of wear pantaloons and a vest, which is sort of hand embroidered with tractors or dogs or whatever you want to represent yourself with. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you know, it's called clinch back wrestling. They start with an under and over grip and they start from there, and it's beautiful, and these guys are highly skilled, and I had a go, obviously. And the first guy I wrestled with, I tossed him around like a rag doll, but he was just beginning. And so then I got with a guy with comparable weight as me, and he threw me around like a rag doll, you know. And I should know a little bit about, you know, wrestling and stuff after 20 years of jiu-jitsu. But, you know, it was a different style and a different approach, and it was really something to behold. But actually, one of the most interesting guys I ever met up there was a legendary shepherd called Joss Naylor. He's in his 80s now, probably coming up to his 90s. And he's probably one of the greatest long distance runners that this country has ever produced, because in the 70s he ran 109 miles in 19 hours 50 minutes.
God damn.
And he climbed the equivalent of 27,000 feet or 29,000 feet, which are over 27 peaks.
God damn.
And so that's sort of like the same height as Everest. And the guy's built like a butterfly. He's a very slight man. And I got to interview him during the course of this film, and he had one leg bigger than the other because he'd been such a prolific runner. He used to run down the scree, and he'd always have his right leg going down, acting as a brake. And
wow.
His right leg was considerably bigger than his left.
Crazy. That's crazy. Darren, I could talk to you about your films for literally 5 hours. We're not going to get into Ozelador, which is your very, very cool film about capoeira. It's a fantastic film. If anyone has even a passing interest in capoeira, I suggest you check that out. But because of time constraints, I want to dive straight into the one that is probably most appropriate for the people listening to this, which is your epic documentary about my jiu-jitsu instructor and your close friend and partly instructor, Roger Gracie. Buddy, please tell me how this came about. So from the beginning, the inception, when you decided it was a good thing to create a film about Roger.
I'll be honest with you, I have to mention Ozelador. I had the idea to make a film because I just started to notice. I was playing capoeira before I started jiu-jitsu, and I started to notice I was meeting these guys from Brazil that had no really little education, left school at 11, and they were being handed honorary doctorates by American universities because they had re-educated themselves. They had gone to school late and, you know, taken a more formal structure. But they were all invested with this beautiful and how should we say, organic wisdom that they'd gained throughout the years. And it made me realize that perhaps I had spent a lot of time doing things that were not detrimental to me, but they were, I'd always been a bit of a hedonist. So I spent probably too long riding a skateboard and, you know, doing all these things that made me feel good. And I thought, I need to go and get re-educated. Uh-huh. And so I enrolled at university and I wanted to be an animator. Didn't have a course. So I took film and media. I didn't finish the course, but I'd done 2 years and I felt that I'd learned enough by that point, or I had an epiphany and realized that I was the only person in the classroom that wanted to go and make films. So around that time, I met Maurizio and I started training jiu-jitsu at the Third Space. And literally within weeks of meeting Maurizio, I thought, right, here's the subject. They say you should make a film about your something you're passionate about. And I started to film Maurizio, and that would probably be 2002. Mm-hmm. I started first filming Maurizio. And so I ran the two films concurrently, filming Roger and Maurizio, and spending a lot of time. I lived in Brazil for 3 years in the suburbs. And so I was focusing on Ozelador and Capoeira, and the Hot of the Cassius, which was the subject of that film. But at the same time, I was making the film about, the Gracies and researching that. And actually that led me to become very good friends with Roger's mother, Hayla Gracie, who was a formidably, contemporary and enlightened, strong woman. That's the best description I can give. She's a very special person. And
I'll never forget the defining memory I have of her is 1 year, I think Roger had just become a black belt, and he decided, for whatever reason, he didn't go to compete at the Pan Ams. And I remember the story somehow got back to all of us that she absolutely crapped on him, like, because she's like, you've got four tournaments, you have to do a year, that's all you need to focus on, and I can't believe you've done this. And he was like, there's Roger, he's already a world champion a couple times over, this monstrous 6'5" jiu-jitsu master, and like his little mom is like breaking his spirit. I thought that was classic.
Yeah, honestly, Nicky, it's I don't know anyone with a better more historically detailed vision of the Gracie family. And, you know, there's no family in history like the Gracies. Mm-hmm. Let's be absolutely clear about that. They've got a lot of detractors and doubters. But let's be clear, there is no family. That the continuity that family has shown and the lineage that creates that continuity and passes on that collective knowledge, that's impossible. That's impossible to recreate. It really is a case of you couldn't make that up, really. You're going to have this succession of cousins, uncles, brothers that were going to go a span over 100 years and create something which would revolutionize the entire fighting ideals which would come to accept, that were really based on nothing other than hype and media for a lot of years. You know, mm-hmm. There weren't any really truly authentic martial arts around, mm-hmm. before the Gracies turned up. They're purported to be, and people wrote about certain things, but it became a very ambiguous term to be a martial artist, you know. Unless you were a pure Muay Thai fighter, or uh-huh. there was a lot of bullshit. If you excuse my French,
yeah, for sure there was.
Yeah, but they changed everything, and that woman really understands the how that came about. And if no one's read her book, the Carlos Gracie biography, I can recommend that highly. That's a really good read.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but I've heard good things about it. Definitely.
And so I'm not surprised that Roger has such a strong will and an eloquence in defeat, because he's fully aware of his heritage and who he represents. He says right at the start of the film, where every time I step on the mat, I represent my family. And he's acutely aware of that. Mm-hmm. And that's what separates Roger. He fights for maybe, I'm not say pure reasons, but they're pure in origin. They're pure in origin. We can all conceive what it's like to fight for your family.
For sure. That's a very powerful motivator.
Yeah, exactly. But not when you can look back through history and see all your uncles, brothers, and you're surrounded by that. Then it becomes something completely inherent.
Yeah, and that's where, I mean, I'm guessing that's obviously where the name Tradition, that's why you chose the name Tradition, because it is that tradition that Roger was carrying forwards. And there's something to be said for that. It's a dying, I mean, back in the day, your dad was a baker, which meant you were a baker, which meant your kid was going to be a baker, et cetera, et cetera. Or you had this family that was involved in a specific trade or a specific skill, and you carried these traditions forwards. And I think that is fading very rapidly in the modern world. And yes, to see it, there's two things that compound. First, it's the Gracies are continuing that tradition and carrying it forward, but also that they're doing it in such an intense endeavor, which is fighting. I mean, it would be one thing if there was a family that made pots, you know, like, or another family that raised amazing sheep, and we can respect those things and admire those things. But I think when it comes to the Gracies, it's the fact that they're doing it through combat that really it flicks some deep switches within our psyches, for sure.
I think that's a very good point. I think one thing that a common denominator I've seen all the Gracies display is that they relish the competition. They never let the idea of a defeat stand in the way of the competition. And even if they lose, win, draw, it doesn't matter. If they feel that they can recognize what it takes to be at that level, they recognize. So that they have a complete respect, and because they know what it was like, what it's like to arrive and step on the mat and represent and fight for something, whether that's your thing or their thing, it doesn't matter. There's a camaraderie that crosses over, and even their opponents, I can see that they have a maximum respect. If they've come prepared to fight, if they've come to display and show something of an aesthetic beauty, which is, I think this is always, I'm a very aesthetic person, and you know, you can glance around, and you've been on the mat for so many years, you can glance around the Jiu-Jitsu Academy, and you notice the obtuse, you notice the things that aren't looking as good as and slick. But you can look across. It's the same when a boxer, you hear them say, they literally can stand behind them and hear how that person's hitting a bag. It's the same in jiu-jitsu. You can look along and you can see the aesthetic.
I've always loved that. It's cool to hear that you appreciate that, because it's something, I mean, what we do, it's jiu-jitsu. There's this tendency for people to just be concerned about who's the toughest, who can tap who, who's the best, right? But there is a different level to it as well, which is when jiu-jitsu really, really just looks like an art. And I think when you watch Roger move, it's very different. And he's almost like, I always describe him as this kind of hydraulic jiu-jitsu robot. There's no wasted effort, no wasted movement. And to say that about it, I think it's partly because he's so big, and if he's got to move, it costs a lot of energy. So he makes sure he uses it properly. He doesn't move when he doesn't have to, because it just would exhaust him. But that's what I've always been looking for in jiu-jitsu, is that high level of expression where it's just good to look at.
Yeah. There's guys that are very over and they really display. It's something to behold. I mean, like Braulio, for example, he's got a very beautiful jiu-jitsu. You know, there's some Terere, I thought was an amazing jiu-jitsu, you know, beautiful jiu-jitsu. And some guys, but what I think what sets Roger apart is that everyone says it, but he's such a basic jiu-jitsu, such a very clean anaconda jiu-jitsu, where he just overcomes, not just physically, but mentally. And he starts to question, the guy starts to question himself. You know, we've all been there. You feel like a swaddled child. And I think Roger's, obviously, his physical attributes have taken in places that perhaps no other Gracie could have gone. in his era, because he was a big guy, and to compete in that absolute, you needed to be a little bit bigger guy, you know, to go all the way. You know, we've seen some great fighters come close, you know, Teodoro and Marcelo Garcia and Cinco, but it's that extra weight and etc. That is the differential on the absolute title. Mm-hmm. But Roger's biggest asset is I've known Roger nearly 20 years now, since he was a boy. I've never seen Roger raise his voice.
You know, I've never seen that either. That's the weirdest thing.
I've never seen Roger raise his voice. I've never seen him needless. You know, I've never seen him really talk behind someone's back. I've never seen him do that. He just dismisses. He doesn't occupy his mind. I've never seen anyone who can be so. He's got a sage head when it comes to fighting. He's got an amazing knowledge of a fight, and I think he draws from that, and he's able to stay calm and mm-hmm. focus. Mm-hmm. His focus is immense. It's immense. I've seen Roger 10 minutes before the biggest fight in his life yawning.
That's wild.
It's
I would say that you've, I mean, if we trace the film, you go through, you have footage in there of his fight against Jacare back in Brazil, when he lost a pretty controversial decision after breaking Jacare's arm. And then it's my understanding that you went backstage and caught glimpses of Jacare with his broken arm. And then you trace that all the way through to Roger then beating Jacare in ADCC with the choke. And it's showing how it's not just always about winning, it's about coming back from pretty dark places, because that must have been devastating to the guy, you know, to lose in that fashion and then lose again to Shande, and he still kept at it and eventually got the titles.
Yeah, I mean, Roger is magnanimous. And if there's one thing, because we were all in Brazil at the time, and I was living out there at the time, and my Portuguese was just coming then, and I realized very quickly that, you know, Roger won more perhaps as a it was an interesting thing, because he conducted himself in the correct way, and even Jacare alludes to it that his supporters are perhaps more problem than Roger, and he actually has got total respect. But what Roger gained that day was symbolic capital. You can lose the title but still be the winner, as it were, because his comportment was, as the Brazilians say, his comportment was completely without fault. He's always been that magnanimous in defeat, and that is a mark of a real sportsman, and people can respect that. For sure. As a representative, you couldn't ask for more.
For sure. I mean, I think some people forget that, you know, the Gracie family is such a big family that they're bound to be good and bad characters within it, and there definitely are some Gracies who are not good people. No matter what anyone tells you, some of them are not good people. No, it's not many, but there's a few who I really have no respect for. They will not be named. However, the fact that Roger has risen to be the pinnacle and the representative of the family is, to me, such a good thing, because he is truly a wonderful human being. You know, he's done things behind the scenes that no one sees, like help certain people out with money, like... I remember when I first arrived at the academy, I was too poor to train, and he just let me train for free. And he's just one of those very special, very good, very high quality people. And that's why I think it's one of the reasons he's so successful as well, is because, you know, the story, life gives from the giver and takes from the taker, and he's a giver, dude. And he's just a wonderful, wonderful person.
Yeah. I understand. I've not met many Gracies that I didn't like. I'll be honest, because there's always something that I can draw. But I might not agree with someone, but if I see him committed, for me, that's a big thing. Someone who really, really, I do really, I like to commit to things. And so when I see someone committed, I may not agree with you, but I can enjoy your commitment, you know.
Agreed.
I enjoy that. But I think a lot of people just see Gracie as a collective, like a group of guys that just sit around a table and plot their next thing. It isn't that way. It's a fractious family, like any family. And so, and it's exacerbated by all, they all do the same thing. And so you're going to get different ideas. Mm-hmm. You're going to get different, you're going to get different factions that are uphill. But what Kid Peligro said it best is that, you know, they argue a lot. But when someone attacks the family, they come together.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely come together. And that's what family should do.
Agreed. That's what should totally do. Agree. So, Darren, my brother, I know you're a busy guy and you probably have to get ready to jet off to the jungles of Colombia to film a documentary about the cocaine manufacturers or something similar. I want to thank you so much for sharing your time with us and for creating this wonderful film. I'm going to put some links on this post of this podcast where people can get your film. And if they want to find out more about you, it's my understanding they can check out bantamfilms.com. Is that correct?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Darren, what a great pleasure and honor it is for me to host you on the show.
Let me just finish quickly, Nick, is that when we used to train together, wow, some time ago, 12 years ago, we used to train together. I remember we worked real hard for a while. We used to meet regularly twice a week and just conditioning. And we both had a kind of a dream. We both had projects that we were pursuing on a small scale. And it's a beautiful thing to see when you see people arrive and take something that they nurtured and develop it into something. So it's been a pleasure, Nick, to see your development and the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood development. And
my friend, thank you.
For your praise you heap on me. And I look forward to the next time then we can hit the mat together.
Dude. You're of the many hundreds of people I've met on this journey, you're one of my very favorite, dude. Honestly, you're one of those people, whenever I see you, always bring a smile to my face. And thanks for being who you are, my brother.
Thank you, my man. Okay. Take care.
Peace. Well, I really hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Darren truly is a special individual. And I meant it when I said it, that he is, the secret to his happiness is the fact that he is a player of the game of life and not just a spectator. And I think that we can all do well to follow his example and, you know, take risks and be adventurous and choose things that inspire us. And he's done that with his life and it's paid dividends. I remember when I first met Darren, he was in a lot of credit card debt, living in this tiny little studio apartment where he worked out of and lived out of. It was a one bedroom place. I'll never forget. I went to visit him there one night and he just had faith that his film career and his films were going to become successful. And he didn't care that he wasn't making a lot of money and that he didn't have a healthcare plan. He just followed his vision. And the fruits of it is that it took him all over the world. He's had this incredible life. And now he's also become successful. And he's just a true inspiration. And I believe when you step up and you take the risks and you follow your joy, you follow what inspires you, that the universe will reward you. And as I said, he's living proof. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode. I thoroughly recommend you check out his film Tradition. As I said, you can find it on our site, which is store.jiu-jitsubrother.com. Just navigate your way over there and click on books and videos and you will find it there. Okay, guys, have a great week. Until next time, peace out.